The work of this church in the world is realized through the generous financial support of all who call this place home. Along with the gifts and time and talent, ours is a shared ministry. You have a role to play here. Church membership is open to all. For more information, go to uusf.org.
Our reading is The Moment for Visionary Narratives by Adrienne Marie Brown. This is adapted from an article written by Adrienne Marie Brown after the 2016 election. It is unfortunately still relevant today and gives us an idea of how to use stories to help keep hope and action alive. Adrienne Marie Brown writes, "It feels like new media platforms launch every day, but are only being used to tell the same old stories, enforcing the current limits of our collective imagination. And it is clearer than ever that we are currently trapped inside the imagination of people who are not committed to a future that includes us or even happens on this planet. There's a body of people across the globe whose ancestors organized the world around a few core ideas that are incompatible with human survival on Earth, who imagined themselves as white royalty amongst black and brown masses, who bent policy, economy, and culture to realize this imagined supremacy. And now we are in it, and it is in us. Now we need to be the storytellers of the next phase of the future. And we need to concern ourselves not just with the content of our liberating imaginings, but with how we imagine it together." Octavia Butler predicted this moment in her parables, a president elected on a platform of white nationalism, misogyny, and anti-intellectualism, even down to the slogan, "Make America Great Again." Butler was a black science fiction writer, and her vision was radical. She was able to imagine the pattern of the news cycles unfurling in the future to tell us about the most likely outcomes and the new problems we would face. Visionary fiction speaks of art that is self-aware, that understands there's no such thing as neutral. Art either advances or regresses our evolution, justice, and liberation. We use the term to identify work that centers marginalized communities, understands change as a bottom-up process, challenges single hero narratives, and moves beyond the binary of dystopia or utopia. It was important for us to gather these stories from people doing the work because we believe that all organizing is science fiction, shaping the future to be a just and liberated place. We aren't the beginning of visionary fiction, and Butler isn't the only one who is writing it. The work of Samuel Delaney, Stephen Barnes, Nalo Hopkinson, Walter Mosley, Cherie Renee Thomas, Nedima Okafor, Ursula Le Guin, Tana Nareeve Du, Doris Lessig, Marge Piercy, and many others fits this category. But imagination is only the first step. We have to get our stories to the people.
So how many of us have felt like the man in our story, where we held our stories and all of a sudden it unraveled or it broke and we didn't know what to do? I know I've definitely been there as a minister, as a parent, as a U.S. citizen, and as a human being. Each time I've come to a place where my story has unraveled or broken, and I couldn't hold on to what was true any longer, I encountered a new story or a new perspective that helped me build strength again. What about you? How many have had stories from others that have helped build them back up after that? Yeah. Stories are powerful. It's why they make up so much of our worship. They can be inspiring, educational, humorous, and insightful. They help us find new ways of being in the world. As I reflected on personal stories of resilience in my life this past week, I kept coming back to my parents, Jess and Judy Greenlee. They were high school sweethearts, married when they were 18 and 19 years old. And over the 50 years they were married, they went through some pretty tough times, to name just a few, and this is just a few. The loss of a child, major health concerns, job uncertainty, premature birth of a child, death of parents, loss of their retirement, and so much more. My dad battled cancer for 6 years before he died, and he met each day with a determination of getting through what the day would bring. Even on the last day he was conscious, he made an effort to get out of bed, come into the living room, watch Jeopardy, and ask for a root beer. Right? He heard that song start to play, and he's like, oh no, I need to be out there. My mom has been the same way, determined to keep going. She's currently recovering from a stroke and keeps engaging in all the activities that help her improve as much as she can. Both of them have been models of resilience in my life, that determination to just keep going no matter what, because to stop was not an option. Who did you think of when you were thinking of a personal story of resilience in your life? Was it a story of your own resilience? Was it a story of family members or loved ones, ancestors? I forgot to tell you, this service is interactive. Well, the one thing that we know about stories is that when we share them, we get to hold them more dear. We get to spread their message. So I want you to turn to each other and share your stories of personal resilience. And these are your personal ones. Again, you have permission to share what you'd want to share and what you don't share. If you don't want to speak to somebody, you can sit quietly and reflect on your own. And those online, if you would like to share in the chat, please do so. Or if you're watching service with someone, share with each other in your space. So let's take a few moments to share our stories with each other. In our reading, Adrienne Marie Brown encouraged us to get the stories of resilience out in the open, to share them with one another, and most importantly, to make space for those stories we don't hear that have so much wisdom. Like the story Sam shared about Tsuji Nakamura and the blue LED light, who persisted despite all the walls put in place to deter his work. I want to tell you another story about resilience from history. It's Dolores Huerta's story. This is taken from the U.S. Department of Labor Hall of Honor induction of Dolores Huerta. Raised by a single mother in the farm worker community of Stockton, California, as a young girl, Huerta observed the inhumane conditions faced by migrant farm workers and dedicated her life to the men and women who harvest America's fields. Huerta co-founded the National Farm Workers Association with Cesar Chavez in 1962. The union later became the United Farm Workers, the oldest Latino organization to come out of the civil rights movement and the largest farm worker organization in America. Working side by side with Chavez, Dolores' accomplishments are vast. Huerta secured state-backed aid for dependent families and disability insurance for injured California farm workers. She directed a national grape boycott to protest the dangers of pesticides on grape pickers, which resulted in the entire California table grape industry changing its practices. And she negotiated the first ever collective bargaining agreement with an agricultural business to secure better wages and working conditions for farm workers. Huerta was an outspoken advocate for world peace, the rights of immigrants, women, minorities, at-risk youth, and LGBT Americans. During her decades of leadership, Huerta endured beatings, death threats, and arrest for leading nonviolent protests to give a voice to the voiceless. The unflappable leader had her bones, but never her spirit broken in the struggle. In 2012, President Obama awarded Huerta the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor, for her lifetime of advocacy on behalf of the undeserved. In addition, Huerta received the Eleanor Roosevelt Human Rights Award in 1998, and as of 2015, I'm not sure if this is still the case, she was a board member of the Feminist Majority Foundation, the Secretary Treasurer Emeritus of the United Farm Workers of America, and the president of the Dolores Huerta Foundation. Wow, what a life, right? This is a woman who oftentimes did not take credit for the work that she did. And not only that, not only did she do all this advocacy work, she did it while raising 11 children as a single mother. In reading about her, I learned the origin of the chant. I have said so many times, especially up in Washington State where I served before, and it was a huge agricultural area, and oftentimes we would be out doing immigrant right work and agricultural workers' work. And the phrase, si se puede, si se puede. Oftentimes it's credited to Cesar Chavez, but here in an NPR interview, she tells the story of its origin and how she was the person that actually brought it to the movement. She says, "We were in Arizona. We were organizing people in the community to come to support us. They had passed a law in Arizona that if you said boycott, you could go to prison for 6 months. And if you said strike, you could go to prison. So we were trying to organize against that law, and I was speaking in a group of professionals in Arizona to see if they could support us. And they said, oh, here in Arizona, you can't do that. In Arizona, no se puede, no, you can't. And I said, no, in Arizona, sí se puede. And I went back to our meeting that we had every night there, and I gave that report to everybody, and when I said, si se puede, everybody started shouting it, si se puede, si se puede. And that became the slogan of our campaign in Arizona, and now is the slogan for immigrant rights movement that you know on posters. We can do it. I can do it. Si se puede. I love the imagination of this story. When walls are being put up, you can't say boycott, you can't say strike, and the answer is, si se puede. Yes, we can. These are the stories we need at the forefront right now, the ones that use that visionary narrative to redefine a world that seems to be getting smaller, scarier, and centered in fear. Instead of being stopped in our movement, we need to find the paths that open up if only we used our imagination and search for them. If you haven't already, I want you to think about a resilient story from history. Who has inspired you through their work or life? And again, I'm going to invite you to turn to one another and share your stories of resilience from history online. Share with each other through chat or with the person with you. And if you want to sit quietly, you still are welcome to do that. Please share. How many of you heard a story you hadn't heard before? Or remembered a story that you had known but didn't have in your mind? Yeah. Again, stories are powerful. They can be found in our libraries, in our films, in our conversations, and in our worship. They are everywhere around us. We just have to take the time to remember them or search them out. We definitely need to share them, because that is what will get us through difficult times, challenging times, even when our own stories seem to be unraveling or broken, or even when the stories around us, maybe of our nation, seem to be unraveling or broken. Let us remember the stories shared here today and continue to read, to learn, to share, and to make room for all the stories. All the stories. May it be so.
In 1960, if you wanted to make light, you used an incandescent bulb. That wasted a lot of energy. Lighting in the US used as much energy as millions of cars. Then in 1962, General Electric invented the red LED. A couple years later, the green LED came along. We were so close to being able to make screens on mobile phones, monitors that weren't huge and boxy, energy-efficient white light bulbs. We just needed to figure out how to make a blue LED. But then progress stalled. Even with thousands of researchers working on it, the science was too hard. People tried, but after 3 decades of failure, most folks gave up and assumed it was impossible. People like to think that the arc of science was continual progress, but when the going got tough, many people quickly gave up. One person, Shuji Nakamura, didn't give up. In the late 80s, Nakamura's company was struggling, so he went to the company's president and asked him to take a risk and let him stop his normal research and work on the blue LED. He knew that he couldn't do it on his own, so his first step was to move from Japan to Florida to learn how some other folks were trying to solve part of the puzzle. When he went there, his coworkers shunned him because he didn't have a PhD. They wouldn't let him use the equipment, so he had to build his own. That inspired him to prove all of them wrong. When he got back from Florida, he tried to make a blue LED using gallium. 99% of the LED researchers thought that gallium would fail. That's why he chose to research it. He wanted to make sure his research was unique, groundbreaking. He couldn't do that by following the pack. When he tried using the state-of-the-art machines, it did fail. So he built his own. The other researchers didn't know how to make their own machines, but because of the discrimination he faced in Florida, this wasn't his first time having to figure things out on his own. He worked 12-hour days every single day with no weekends or holidays for a year and a half. But then he made 2 breakthroughs. But despite that, the company president that was supporting his research retired, and the new president told him to stop, even though he was making progress. So Nakamura went behind his back, published the research he had already done, and kept at it. He kept ignoring the repeated orders to stop, and he trusted his own judgment. He followed his heart even when it seemed like everyone was against him, and before long, he finished and he made a blue LED. His company went from the verge of bankruptcy to making billions of dollars, mostly off of that one invention. And as thanks for all of his hard work, his company gave him a bonus of $170. The company didn't respect him, but he gained international renown along with a Nobel Prize for his work. Now he's at UC Santa Barbara, and he has his own company where he's working on things like medical applications for LEDs. Now, we don't come to church to learn about electronics, but we do come here to learn about what to do when it seems like everything is dark and you're about to fail, what to do when your coworkers are elitist and don't respect you, your boss doesn't like you, no one thinks that you can succeed. Sometimes, even when it seems like the progress through history has stopped, when it seems like you've been working on something for months or years, sacrificing nights and weekends to no avail, when you just want to do your part and make the world a better place, but everyone is against you. Sometimes you prove everyone wrong and you win.